Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. The realization that we are vulnerable to terrorism has changed the United States. Our government spends vast amounts of time and money in an effort to monitor those who wish to do us harm and stop those who plan to do us harm by any means possible. And my guest believes no single department or agency has done more for national security than the one he spent three decades working for, the Central Intelligence Agency. Michael Morell also admits the CIA has made plenty of mistakes and that only by admitting and scrutinizing those mistakes can it move forward. Morell retired from CIA as deputy director in 2013. His new book is called The Great War of Our Time, the CIA's Fight Against Terrorism from Al-Qaeda to ISIS. He will be in town May 29th to speak at the Bush Institute. Michael, welcome to Think.
Chris, it's great to be with you. Thank you for having me.
So you say that no department or agency has done more to keep the U.S. safe than CIA. That's a strong claim to make.
It is, but this war against the particular type of extremism that we're dealing with is largely an intelligence war. You can't understand this enemy, you can't make policy regarding the enemy, and you can't carry out that policy and operations against it without first-rate intelligence. And that's what the Central Intelligence Agency is all about, is collecting secrets and making sense of them for the President of the United States and his national security team. So we've been, Chris, at the center of this fight.
While for some Americans the activities of Al-Qaeda have fallen a bit off the radar screens, you remain deeply concerned about the ongoing threat to U.S. security from Al-Qaeda and its offshoots. What has happened within that organization since the death of Osama bin Laden?
So I think one of the most important points, and something I talk about in the book, is that we are all now focused on ISIS, and rightfully so. But as we focus on ISIS, we can't lose sight of Al-Qaeda and its offshoots, as you call them. In fact, what I say in the book, and what I've been saying in recent days, is that the threat that we face from the Al-Qaeda organizations to the homeland is greater today than the threat we face from ISIS. The threat we face from ISIS, Chris, really is in two forms. One is their ability to direct an individual who's traveled from the United States to Syria and Iraq to fight for them, to direct that person back here to conduct an attack. And the other threat we pose from ISIS is their ability through social media, Madison Avenue-style social media, to radicalize young men and young women in the United States to conduct attacks. We've seen a couple of those, one in Dallas itself. So that's the threat from ISIS. But from Al-Qaeda, we still face a fairly sophisticated threat, particularly from the Al-Qaeda group in Yemen, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. It was that group that has tried the last three attempted attacks in the United States, the 2009 underwear bomber, the attempt to bring down that airliner on Christmas Day, the so-called printer cartridge plot in 2010, the hiding of sophisticated explosives in a printer cartridge in an attempt to bring down cargo planes, U.S. cargo planes, and then a third attempt in 2011 to make a non-metallic suicide vest that you could sneak onto an aircraft to bring down an aircraft. So this is a very sophisticated organization who has the capability to attack us, and we can't lose focus of that even as we focus on ISIS.
Do you have any concerns that our focus on keeping the aviation industry particularly protected causes us not to see areas of risk elsewhere?
So I think it's really important to focus on what we think they're focusing on, right? And they have always had an interest in aviation. Why? Because it's a symbol of the West. It's a symbol of Western power. It's a symbol of Western economy. So they've always had an interest in going after aviation, and they still do. That's one of the things we learned from the original set of bin Laden documents that were released. You know, there was just another set released today. The original set talked about bin Laden's continuing interest in attacking airlines. So important for us to focus on what they're focused on.
ISIS, of course, claimed responsibility for that attack at the Garland event organized to showcase cartoon drawings of the Prophet Muhammad. Is it reasonable to believe that the Islamic State actually ordered that attack, or are we looking, does it appear that we're looking at two young men who, for whatever reason, self-radicalized based on their exposure to material that ISIS had made available online?
So I don't believe, Chris, that ISIS directed the attack in the sense of actually communicating directly with these two individuals, telling them what to do, when to do it, how to do it. I think this is in the self-radicalization lone wolf category. I do think ISIS encourages people to conduct attacks, and I think they did that in this case. And I think these two individuals listened to them. So it's, you know, directed in a very tangential way. But I think it really fits into the kind of lone wolf self-radicalization category.
You were with President Bush on 9/11. Can you tell
Yes.
us about your most enduring memories of that day?
So it was, for me, a day of the intensity of doing my job mixed with moments of the surreal. I'll give you an example of the intensity of doing my job. On the flight from, and I talk about this in the book in detail, on the flight from Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana to Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska, the president asked to see me. And I walked into his office on Air Force One, and it was the president, me, and Andy Card. And the president said, Michael, who did this? And I said, Mr. President, I don't have any intelligence that would indicate one way or another who did this, but I'll give you my opinion, give you my professional opinion. He said, I understand. Now, you know, get on with it. I told him, Mr. President, I think there are two countries in the world, Iraq and Iran, who have the capability to do this, but have everything to lose and absolutely nothing to gain by attacking us like this. No, I said, Mr. President, I think the trail is ultimately going to lead to Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. And I told the president that I would bet my children's future on that. Now, I've never told my kids that, but I told the president I would bet their future on that. And then he said to me, Michael, when will we know? And what I did for him at that moment is walk him through the previous terrorist attacks in the United States. And in each one of those attacks, the East Africa bombing attacks, the Cole attack, the Khobar Towers attack, how long it took us before we really knew. And it varied dramatically. And I walked him through all that. And I said, Mr. President, we may know soon, and it may take some time. So that's an example of the intensity of doing my job, Chris. An example of the surreal was landing at Andrews Air Force Base that night back in Washington. When you landed Andrews from the west to the east, as we did that night, you out of the left side of the aircraft is the Pentagon. And when I looked out the left side of the aircraft that night, I saw an F-16 on the wingtip. It was from the D.C. Air National Guard. It was so close, you could see the facial features of the pilot. And in the background, you could see the still-burning Pentagon. So that's an example of the surreal. And that was really the whole day going back and forth. I remember it like it was yesterday.
When you were sitting in that school with the president, you wondered if that building could be targeted next.
Right. You know, the president was talking to the vice president, to Condi Rice, getting updates. He was preparing his remarks, you know, to the first remarks to the nation to go back into the classroom. And I was standing there and I was wondering, you know, this is a public event. Everybody knows that the president was going to be here today and everybody's known for quite some time. So, you know, I wondered if somebody was going to fly a plane into that building. And I wondered whether I should walk over to the lead Secret Service agent and mention that to him. But he had quite a worried look on his face. So I think he was worried about that, too.
You had been personally delivering CIA memoranda to the Oval Office in the months leading up to 9/11, warning in many cases that terrorist strikes might be imminent, that bin Laden was determined to strike the U.S. I completely understand that you were as devastated as any American when this actually came to fruition. Was there, though, Michael, part of you that wanted to say, we've been telling you this would happen?
No, not really. You know, there was there was a significant flow of intelligence from April until June. And that intelligence said Al-Qaeda, bin Laden are planning a significant terrorist attack against the United States. It was not clear where, whether it was in the U.S. or whether it was overseas. In fact, most of it appeared to take us overseas. It was not clear when, and it was not clear how. It was frustratingly lacking in details. And then it just went away. It just went away at the end of June. So that was the last thing I was thinking of is you know, somehow we were right. I wish we would have been wrong. Turns out that we did learn, Chris, where that intelligence flow came from. It came from bin Laden going from training camp to training camp in Afghanistan to give talks to his troops. Right, he would visit these guys and he would talk to them to try to boost their morale. And what he was doing in the spring was he was telling them of a great victory to come, a significant victory to come, and that was leaking out. And that's what we were picking up. And I think it went away because as we got closer to September 11th, I think he stopped talking about that kind of thing and went more underground and was less communicative with his own people. And that's why I think it went away. That's where I think it came from. That's where I think it went away.
One weakness revealed by 9/11 in U.S. national security was the lack of cohesion between overseas intelligence gathering and domestic law enforcement. When everyone realized how severe the problem was, what did it take to begin to understand how it had gotten that bad and what to do about it?
So my sense, Chris, is that there was absolutely coordination problems between the CIA and the intelligence community in general, the CIA in particular, with the FBI, local law enforcement, state law enforcement. My sense was that was fixed literally 2 weeks after 9/11 of necessity. You know, some people point to the creation of the Director of National Intelligence as fixing that problem. My sense was it was fixed right away, that people just did what they had to do, and they got over cultural problems between organizations. They got over bureaucratic turf problems. They just did what they had to do to protect the country.
How did CIA evaluate the question of whether Iraq had access to weapons of mass destruction in the immediate aftermath of 9/11?
So that's a great question. And there's a view out there, Chris, that it was the Bush White House, it was hardliners in the Bush administration that pushed the intelligence community to that judgment. That's a myth. I talk about this in the book at length. That's a myth. It didn't happen that way. The intelligence community and CIA came to that judgment independently. The only thing I have to tell you to prove that is that we believed that Saddam had these programs prior to President Bush even coming to office. We told this story to President Clinton as well. And we basically said three things. We said that he has chemical weapons. We said he has a biological weapons production capability. And we said that he is in the process of reconstituting his nuclear weapons program. And we were wrong. We were wrong about that, as well as every other intelligence service in the world that looked at this question, as well as the United Nations, as well as serious academics that looked at this question. We were all wrong. And there's a good story behind why we were wrong that we can talk about.
We will do that in just a moment. My guest is Michael Morell, retired deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency and author of the new book, The Great War of Our Time, the CIA's fight against terrorism from Al-Qaeda to ISIS. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Mm-hmm.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Summer Youth with hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with the retired deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Michael Morell. His new book is called The Great War of Our Time, the CIA's fight against terrorism from Al-Qaeda to ISIS. He will be in town May 29th to speak at the Bush Institute. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Michael, if so many agencies, organizations, countries were incorrect about the fact that Saddam Hussein had access to biological weapons and chemical weapons and nuclear weapons, why did everybody draw the wrong conclusions?
So the interesting story, Chris, is that he had a nuclear weapons program in the early 1990s, and he stopped it. We knew that then, and we know it now. We know that he used chemical weapons, that he had chemical weapons, and he used them against the Iranians and his own people. So we knew that he had them. His situation was he had very heavy international sanctions placed against him, and they were crushing his economy, and he desperately wanted them removed. So the decision he made was to end his weapons of mass destruction program temporarily end his weapons of mass destruction program, but hide that fact from his main enemy, the Iranians. He saw those programs as a key deterrent to the Iranians. So he wanted to end the program to get rid of sanctions, but not have the Iranians know it. So how do you end the program and get rid of sanctions? You have a confidence that when you end the program secretly, that the Central Intelligence Agency will see it. So he overestimated our capabilities to see what he was doing. From our perspective, Chris, we made two mistakes. The first mistake we made is that our fundamental responsibility as an agency is to find out what our adversaries are doing and tell the President of the United States. And we did not recruit a human being who was close enough to Saddam Hussein to tell us exactly what he was planning and what he was thinking and what he was doing. That was a mistake. The other mistake, and that was an operational mistake, the other mistake was an analytic mistake. And the analytic mistake was, at the end of the day, analysts have to do two things. They have to tell you what they think about something, but they also have to tell you how confident they are in what they think. And those are two completely different judgments. And if I put on the table, Chris, for all of our listeners, the data that the analysts had at the time and our listeners went through it themselves, they would come to the conclusion that Saddam had these programs. That's where the data took you. But what would have been more important, I think, to have told the president is exactly how confident we were in that judgment. And I think that if we had looked at that question of confidence robustly, we would have said, Mr. President, we think he has these programs, but what you really need to know is we're not that confident in this judgment because a lot of the data is circumstantial. A lot of the data is dated more than 5 years before the UN weapons inspectors left the country, and that our judgment is driven to some significant degree by the fact that we knew he had these programs at one point. And so I think that would have been a completely different message to the president, and that would have been us doing a much better job on the analytic side. So two lessons to be learned there, one operational, one analytic.
There is so much discussion right now over whether it's prudent for the U.S. to strike a deal with Iran to allow regulated, inspected, low-level nuclear enrichment. I know that you are fiercely nonpartisan, but I wonder what insights you can offer as to whether it makes sense to trust Iran to hold up its end of a 15-year deal.
Yeah, so I come at this, Chris, I come at this as an intelligence officer. So I would be advising the president on two different things at this point with regard to Iran. The first is I would be advising the president to whether I, the CIA, could effectively monitor whether the Iranians were doing exactly what they said they're going to do in the agreement? Would I be capable of telling him whether they were cheating or not? So the most interesting aspects of the deal to me would be the inspection aspects. What are you allowed to inspect when? How are you allowed to inspect it? How much time do they have to give you in order to inspect something? All of those transparency pieces of this would be extremely important to me and would be informing my judgment to the president about whether I could really there's no trusting the Iranians here, but whether I could give him any confidence that I'd be able to see them cheating. That's one aspect of what I'd be talking to him about. The other aspect of what I'd be talking to him about is trying to put the nuclear issue into a larger context for him. And that larger context is that the nuclear issue is not the only concern that we have with the Iranians. We actually have a lot of different concerns with the Iranians. One is their desire to be the hegemonic power in the Middle East, their desire to call the shots, their desire to be the big dog on the block, their desire essentially to reestablish the Persian Empire. That's not in our interests. I'd be talking to him about their conducting terrorism as a tool of statecraft, largely against their neighbors. But in one case, they had a plan to assassinate the Saudi ambassador to the United States in a Georgetown, Washington, D.C. restaurant. I'd be talking to him about their support for other international terrorist groups like Hezbollah, which prior to 9/11 had killed more Americans than any other terrorist group. I'd be talking to him about their support for regional insurgent groups designed to overthrow Sunni governments. And the best example of that is Yemen today. So I'd be trying to put this into a larger context. And I would also tell him that it is Iranian state policy for Israel to be wiped off the face of the planet. The Supreme Leader talks about that frequently. A year ago, he put out a 9-point plan for the elimination of the state of Israel. So there's a larger context here in which the nuclear program fits, and I wanted him to make sure that he has that full context as he makes these decisions.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Anna in Louisville. Hello, Anna.
Hi. I just want to say that, you know, I think the Bush administration had an agenda. They wanted, they asked for papers to be written a certain way because they already wanted to go in and invade. If they had waited a little longer for the UN inspectors to go in, it would have taken a week or two more weeks. They were pretty close to getting the inspection done. If they had waited for that inspection, they would have found out there were no WMDs.
Michael, would you like to respond to that?
Yeah, I'd make a couple points. One is, on the question of weapons of mass destruction, they did not push us to some place where we were not, right? We, as I explained earlier, it was our judgment that he had this stuff. And I don't believe that a couple more weeks of inspections would have changed that. I do want to say, however, on a different intelligence question with regard to Iraq, we were pushed. And that was on the question of Iraq's relationship with al-Qaeda. We had concluded that while there might have been some historical conversations between the Iraqi intelligence service and al-Qaeda, that there was no connection at the time between the two, that there was no Iraqi involvement in 9/11, that there was no Iraqi foreknowledge of 9/11, that they were just as surprised as everybody else. That was our judgment. And we were pushed by members of the vice president's office, Scooter Libby in particular, to withdraw a paper that we had written because he disagreed with that paper, and to rewrite the paper to see things more his way. And we responded to that pressure exactly as the taxpayers should expect. We didn't budge an inch. We didn't withdraw the paper. We didn't give in. And to his credit, to his great credit, the president of the United States became aware of this pressure on us. And he said to us, I want you to continue to call it like you see it. I don't want you to respond to any outside pressure for you to see things a certain way. It was a remarkably important thing for a president of the United States to say to us.
Was the killing of Osama bin Laden as important for reducing the operational capabilities of al-Qaeda by 2011 as it was for its symbolic value?
So I think it's a great question, Chris. I think we went into this believing that removing him from the battlefield, capturing or killing him, would have both those effects. But when we went through the intelligence that we took away from that compound, the documents, the computers, all the hard drives, and we went through all of that, we were surprised by what we learned. We went into this thinking that he was largely the ideological leader of al-Qaeda and that he didn't have his hands on the organization on a day-to-day basis. But what we found when we looked at those documents was that he was not only managing this organization day-to-day, he was micromanaging it. He was approving appointments, even at kind of mid-levels of the organization. He was approving how money was spent. He was very, very interested in al-Qaeda's operational planning. He was very, very interested in continuing attacks against the United States of America. So I think at the end of the day, it's still important symbolically to remove the ideological leader, but I think it was even more important to remove him as the operational day-to-day manager of this group.
Take us through the intelligence that led to that capture and killing of Osama bin Laden and the process by which President Obama made the call to allow the operation.
So I have, Chris, in the book, a whole chapter on this. It's called the No Mickey Mouse Operation. That was the code name for this thing inside the White House. In August of 2010, our counterterrorism officers came to Director Panetta and me, and they said, we have found a guy named Abu Ahmed al-Kuwaiti, who we believe is a courier to bin Laden. And we have followed him to where he lives in a place called Abbottabad, Pakistan. Upscale Pakistani city, upscale neighborhood, happens to be the same city as where the Pakistanis have their version of West Point. And they told us this, and they told us all about Abu Ahmed al-Kuwaiti and his history. His association with bin Laden prior to 9/11, his association with the 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed after 9/11, some detainees telling us that he was bin Laden's courier. And they told us about the very, very unique features of this compound, and they showed us pictures. Very unique security features, 12 to 18-foot walls topped with barbed wire, a couple of gates blocking access to the compound. The compound divided up, so it's difficult to move around the compound. Very few windows in the main house. A balcony that had a privacy wall. And I remember Director Panetta saying, well, who puts a privacy wall on a balcony? Isn't the whole point to look out, right? Not stop people from looking in. So there were very unique features about this, and they showed us all of that on that first day. And that really began a process of trying to discover much more about what was going on inside this compound. We briefed the White House right away. We briefed the president, I think, in September. And that began a process of putting together an analytic assessment by the end of the year that basically said that we believe that Abu Ahmed al-Kuwaiti is probably harboring Osama bin Laden in that compound. And that analytic judgment led the president to ask for CIA and the United States military to put together options for going after him. And there were many different options, and we went through the upsides and the downsides of each with the president. And he ended up picking the one that he did, which was a hellebore raid into Pakistan by U.S. Navy SEALs to do this job on the ground. And, you know, he had other options. He could have bombed the place with B-2 bombers. There's other types of operations he could have done, but I think he picked the one. I think he picked the best one. He picked the one that would minimize collateral damage, would minimize the killing of women and children, that would best tell us whether bin Laden was there or not and would best ensure that we knew what happened to him. And that would allow us to get the most intelligence we could, that we knew that probably would be with bin Laden if he were there.
I have to ask you about the investigative journalist Seymour Hersh's latest assertions that bin Laden was actually a prisoner of the Pakistani intelligence service at the time he was killed, and that the killing was facilitated by an informer within the intelligence service. Will you comment on that?
Sure. And, of course, he also said that the Pakistanis were aware that we were coming that night, and that they actually assisted our raid that evening. You know, I think the best thing to say is that everything in his article, in my view, is wrong. Chris, I was in every meeting with regard to this issue at the Central Intelligence Agency. It was in every meeting at the White House. I know that a Pakistani informant did not tell us that bin Laden was there. I know that we found the Abbottabad compound and we found bin Laden by following that courier. I know the Pakistanis were not keeping him prisoner there, and I know that from that trove of intelligence which showed that he was running al-Qaeda on a day-to-day basis. I know the Pakistanis were not aware because I heard the president order it. And I was in the room with Director Panetta when we were monitoring the operation to make sure that the Pakistanis didn't see us. I was there when the Pakistanis were informed about what we had done and were incredibly angry, frustrated with us, embarrassed. President of the United States sent me to Pakistan to begin the process of putting the relationship back together. I had very frank conversations with my Pakistani counterparts, which absolutely convinced me that they did not know he was there, and they certainly didn't know we were coming. So Seymour Hersh says that he had his source is a former senior intelligence officer who was in these meetings. Chris, I can tell you he was not in the same meetings that I was in.
My guest is Michael Morell. He is retired deputy director of the CIA and author of a new book called The Great War of Our Time, The CIA's Fight Against Terrorism from Al-Qaeda to ISIS. You can be part of the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Summer Youth with hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Michael Morell. He retired as deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency in 2013, and he has just published a new book called The Great War of Our Time, The CIA's Fight Against Terrorism from Al-Qaeda to ISIS. He'll be in town May 29th to speak at the Bush Institute. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Michael, why did the CIA fail to predict the Arab Spring?
So we got some things right, Chris, with regard to the Arab Spring, and we got some things wrong. One of the things we got right was what I call strategic warning. So, Chris, for years we were telling the president, his national security team, and Congress, our key customers, we were telling them that pressures were building in the Arab world for change, that there were societal pressures, economic pressures, and political pressures for change. And we were right about that. And, you know, that kind of strategic warning is really important for the intelligence community and for CIA to be providing to a president. What we didn't do, one of the things we didn't do, is we didn't say to the president, "Mr. President, we've reached the boiling point here. We're really worried about the next 6 to 12 months for the following reasons." So we did not see the tipping point coming. And in the book, I talk about why. And it was because the main insights that we were getting on the region were from the leaders of those countries and from their intelligence chiefs. And they didn't see the tipping point coming. And it really said to us, we need a better understanding of what's happening on the street. And we need to take advantage much more than we ever have before of social media, where a lot of these ideas ferment and a lot of these ideas spread. Something we did get right once the Arab Spring began was we saw that it would spread. So when Tunisia happened, we actually wrote papers that talked about the significant possibility of this spreading to other Arab countries. So that's something we got right. But we did get one thing wrong once the Arab Spring started, which was we and a lot of other people said that the Arab Spring would, at the end of the day, undercut al-Qaeda, because it would undercut their narrative that violence is necessary for political change. And, you know, maybe that particular dynamic was right, but we missed a couple of other dynamics with regard to al-Qaeda that really made the Arab Spring a boon to al-Qaeda. And those two dynamics, Chris, were one, the Arab Spring in a place like Libya destroyed the intelligence service, the security service, and the military, those institutions that were used to keep extremism under control. And in a place like Egypt, where you still had the capability, people became unwilling to use those capabilities to keep extremists under control because they didn't think they had the political top cover anymore from a president like President Morsi. So al-Qaeda, even in a place like Egypt that had the capabilities, al-Qaeda came back after 25 years. So this Arab Spring actually turns out to be an al-Qaeda spring, and that's how I talk about it in the book.
What happened to the contacts, the assets that the CIA had built within regimes that were ultimately toppled in the Arab Spring?
So one of, you know, like I said, we were talking to the top people, right, and they were giving us their perspective on what was happening. But don't forget, the other dynamic at this time, Chris, is everybody is focused on al-Qaeda. We're focused on al-Qaeda because we're afraid they're going to attack us, and those Arab allies of ours are focused on al-Qaeda. So we're working very, very, very closely with them to stop al-Qaeda attacks in the United States and to stop al-Qaeda attacks in their own countries. And so that's where our focus was. And it was less on understanding the changes that were happening in those societies. It's not an excuse. It's just a reality.
Michael, if you had to put a hard number to it, how many individual human beings are actually actively members of al-Qaeda within the hierarchy? Not sympathizers, not people who might funnel some money their way, but actively in the organization.
So there are many different al-Qaeda groups, right? There's still the al-Qaeda central leadership in Pakistan. There's al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. There's al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb in West Africa. There's al-Qaeda in Somalia. There's al-Qaeda in Yemen. So if I added all of those up, I think we're probably talking in the low thousands. And then if you look at ISIS, right, you're talking about literally tens of thousands. So it's not a huge number. But because only a handful of people can do such significant damage, as we saw on 9/11, in some ways, the size of that number doesn't mean as much as it would in a traditional military confrontation.
We have an email here from Joey in Denton who says, I understand how clandestine operations and anonymity are imperative to many branches of the CIA and segments of the military, but why, after empirical evidence given by the very CIA operatives carrying it out, showed no benefit to enhanced interrogation techniques, did the CIA continue with those techniques?
So this is a very, very important issue, and I think there's a lot of misunderstanding out there about this. Chris, at the end of the day, there are four questions that you have to ask about this program. The first question is, was it legal? You know, was it torture or not? And I think the important point here is at the time the CIA conducted these operations with the approval of the White House and with the approval of the members of Congress who were briefed on it. At the time the CIA carried this out, the Department of Justice told us on numerous occasions that these techniques were legal, these techniques were not torture. So question one answered, at least, you know, in this discussion. Question two was, were they effective or not? And here there's a very significant difference of opinion between the report of Senate Democrats that was released almost a year ago now and the CIA. The report of Senate Democrats says that we did not get a single piece of useful intelligence out of these techniques. The CIA says just the opposite. The CIA says we got a boatload of significant intelligence out of these techniques that produced, that stopped attacks and took additional senior al-Qaeda operatives off the battlefield. I share the CIA view. I mean, I studied this very, very closely when I was deputy director because I was responsible for making sure that CIA's response to the Senate report was as robust as it could be and we could stand behind it. So I came to believe that these techniques were effective. The third question is, Chris, is were they necessary? All right, they were legal and they were effective, but were they necessary? Could you have gotten these, the same information by using other techniques, less coercive techniques, less harsh techniques, less brutal techniques? And the answer to that question is we'll never know. We will never know. But we run into that problem a lot when it comes to these kind of questions. For example, was it necessary for Abraham Lincoln to suspend habeas corpus for the North to win the Civil War? We'll never know the answer to that question. Was it necessary for the United States to drop two atomic bombs on Japan to bring about the timely surrender of the Japanese in World War II? We'll never know the answer to that question.
Well, let me interrupt you for just a minute, and forgive me.
Sure.
We'll never know if less harsh interrogation techniques might have worked because we didn't try those first?
We did. So we tried traditional interrogation techniques, and they worked with some people. So we had over 100 people in this detention program, only 39 of which ever required enhanced interrogation techniques. So for two-thirds of them, traditional interrogation techniques worked. And then of those 39, only three ever faced the harshest of these techniques, waterboarding, because some of the more moderate enhanced interrogation techniques worked on most of those 39. So what I mean when I say we'll never know is, was there some other non-traditional approach that was less coercive than what we did? Would that have worked, right? We'll just never know because we didn't try. The last question, I think, is the most important. And this is a question on which reasonable people can disagree. And this is the question of, okay, it was legal and it was effective, but was it the right thing to do? And on this question, there are two sides to the coin. One side of the coin is, oh my gosh, how can the United States of America, which stands for freedom in the world and human dignity in the world and democracy in the world, how could we ever do these things to another human being? The other side of that coin is, how could we not have done these things because we believed at the time that they were necessary to stop attacks and save American lives? So this question of morality that a lot of people paint as very, very easy, particularly in retrospect, particularly a decade later, is actually a very, very difficult question. And that's where I think the conversation should be. That's where the debate should be. It shouldn't be about whether it was legal or effective. It should be about the morality question.
Is it reasonable to assume that Edward Snowden might have shared secrets with his Russian hosts that were not included in the documents he leaked publicly?
So I say in the book that I am absolutely certain, and I don't know this, right? I don't happen to know this as a fact, but it's my assessment. It's my assessment that both the Chinese intelligence service and the Russian intelligence service approached him and said, "Will you work for us? Will you tell us everything you know? Will you give us all your documents? And we will make you a very, very, very rich person." I believe that Edward Snowden said no to that. I don't believe he willingly helped the Russians or Chinese, because I think that he despises Russian and Chinese intelligence as much as he despises American intelligence. So I don't think he willingly shared. But the fact that he was in China, the fact that he was and still is in Moscow, makes him very vulnerable to giving up information in a way that he doesn't even understand, particularly electronically. And that we'll never know in terms of what the Russian and Chinese might have gotten their hands on.
What evidence is there that the information he leaked tipped off terrorist groups about tactics used to keep them under surveillance?
So the first disclosures occurred in early June 2013. I left my job as deputy director in early August 2013. And in those two months, Chris, I saw terrorist organizations change the way that they communicate internally and between each other because of what they learned in the Snowden disclosures. And those changes in how they communicated made it more difficult for us to understand what they were doing. Subsequent to my departure from the government, I've seen many of my colleagues go before Congress and under oath and in public say that the Snowden disclosures have significantly damaged American counterterrorism efforts and, in fact, aided, I'm not saying solely responsible, but aided in the rise of ISIS.
What is it like to step away from a 30-year career with CIA, knowing that you will continue to follow all of these events as they take place, but that it is someone else's problem now?
So it was probably, Chris, the most difficult thing I ever did. To walk out of a place where you spent 33 years, to walk out of a place where a place that you believe is vitally important to the security of the country, to walk out of a place where the people who work there are incredibly hardworking and incredibly committed is very, very difficult. And I miss it. I must tell you, I miss it. I don't miss knowing all the secrets. I don't miss going to the White House. Gosh knows I don't miss going to Congress. But I do very much miss the mission of protecting America, and I miss being with the people who are so passionate about doing that.
Is there such a thing as just regular office politics in CIA? Do people complain about the quality of the paperclips?
Absolutely. Parking and space are two things you never, ever want to get into a conversation with any CIA officer.
Michael Morell was deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency. He is now retired. His new book is called The Great War of Our Time, the CIA's fight against terrorism from Al-Qaeda to ISIS. He'll be in town May 29th to speak at the Bush Institute. Michael, it's been a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Chris, thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.